You won't miss out on any of the topic. So we started this a couple of weeks ago, talking about lucky numbers, talking about donations in units of 18 to the fundraising after the Japanese earthquake. We talked about the problem of lucky numbers and how we are taught that in Judaism we're not supposed to interpret omens, which I defined as an apparently irrelevant piece of information being used to predict the future. Predicting what's going to happen based on something that really has nothing to do with anything. The black cat crossing your path, the number 13, and so on. And we said that that's prohibited. We gave a couple of reasons for it, whether that's because it leads into idolatry, or whether it's because it's just silly and meaningless and useless, or because you're not turning to God for your support. But then we saw that there are exceptions to the prohibition based on biblical stories and passages in the Talmud. And what we came up with is at the top of the source sheet, I brought it again there, where it says summary, three cases of acceptable lucky numbers. I put the link in the chat again for the source sheet. Number one, messages from God. If the message that you're, if the symbol, the signal that you're relying on is a message from God, that's okay. That's not called a lucky number. So when the servant of Abraham is going to get a wife for Isaac and he asks God for a sign, it's a message from God that he's relying on. Similarly, when Jonathan tells his servant that they should attack the Philistine outpost, if the Philistines say certain things, he's appealing to God in order to get that signal to happen. That's number one. Number two, we said, it's not a problem if the number is actually meaningful. The number represents something. It's a meaningful sum, as I put it on the sheet. It's counting something that is significant. We're going to come back to that today and see some examples of that. And number three, where the sign is irrelevant to the issue at hand, however, it provides an emotional boost, a psychological boost. It's not about deciding, I'm going to do something on that basis. But it makes you feel better because you had that symbol. And again, we'll give examples of that today. So last time, we gave examples of numbers that get their meaning from God, numbers that are effectively messages from God. So we talked about, as an example, the number 26 being used to refer to parnasa, to refer to support. We talked about 36 blessing as a the number meaning life in this world and the next. I was reading Paul's note in the chat. That's why I always ask people not to put notes in the chat. It has a subliminal effect on me. So the 36 representing twice 18, life in this world, life in the next world. And then we took a detour from that and noted that sometimes we assign meaning to particular numbers because of what we find in it. It's really not a message from God. It's almost a message to God from us, or a message for ourselves, like for educational purposes. We talked about the Who Knows One song. We talked about the use of gematria to deduce messages. So there are numbers that we invest with meaning. We talked about 248 symbolizing the human body. We talked about 72 representing chesed, kindness. We talked about 91 symbolizing God. So what I want to do for us at this point is to talk about the numbers which actually convey something significant about what they are counting. So they have meaning. And therefore, Judaism considers them important because of that meaning. We'll be talking about the number 3 in that context, the number 7, the number 8, the number 10. I feel like I should say the letter P or something like that to complete the Sesame Street image. The number 40, the number 600,000. All of those are going to be examples of something that, a number that actually counts something with meaning. And then we'll talk about numbers that we know are irrelevant, but they give us a psychological boost anyway. So if we get through all of that, I want to talk a little bit about what's called intertextuality, numbers that link biblical passages to each other. I'll explain that if we get there. And then at the end, I want to talk about counting Jews and the issue of numbers that we're not supposed to use, the practice of not counting. So we'll hopefully we'll get to all of this. We will see. Okay, we're good? Everyone knows where we're going, what we're doing? Okay, everyone has the source sheet, I hope, at this point. Anyone who joined recently need the link? No? Okay, excellent. So numbers that are meaningful, they represent a meaningful sum. So I mentioned three, the number three, as an example. Three in the Torah often represents a period of transition, a journey. Specifically, when you talk about something happening three times, or something, or having 3 days, a period of 3 days. If you take a look at number one, this is a midrash, which collects threes. In context, this midrash is talking about the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, in which we're told that Abraham and Isaac travel for 3 days until they arrive at Mount Moriah. So it collects other 3 day periods. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and he saw the mountain. Then it quotes me a verse from the book of Hosea, one of these smaller books of prophecy, in which the prophet says, he, God, will revitalize us from 2 days. On the third day, he will raise us up and we will live. And yes, if that sounds familiar because the Christians took it and used it for their own purposes, you are correct. That's not surprising. We've said this before, right? They built it on our structure. So they had a lot of material to draw on. But the verse in context, before the Christians ever took it, is talking about God bringing the Jewish people back to life and, you know, after our devastations. So it's another case in which there is a 3 day journey to God resurrecting the Jewish people. Then you have the third day of the tribes. When the brothers of Joseph come down to Egypt, Joseph makes them cool their heels for a couple of days. And then on the third day, Joseph told them, and so on. On the third day of the spies, not the bad spies, the good spies in Tanakh, the spies Joshua sends to the city of Jericho, he says, you shall hide there for 3 days. Actually, no, sorry, it's a 3 day hiding on their way back from Jericho. The Torah is given to the Jews after 3 days of preparation. Jonah is in the fish for 3 days and three nights. All of these are journeys in which people are supposed to change. Something meaningful is supposed to happen. There's a transition that is happening. This is not to say that all transitions in the Torah are automatically going to be 3 days, right? Sometimes you need more than 3 days. Moses waits to be invited into God's cloud on Sinai, and he waits 6 days. It takes the Jews 49 days to get to Mount Sinai. It's not always a 3 day journey. However, the point in all of these cases, and maybe I rushed through them a little bit too quickly, I didn't even go through all of them that you see here on the list. But the idea is that when somebody goes through a 3 day period in the Torah, it is a period of transition, of change, it is a journey. And so the number three comes to mean that kind of change. Interestingly, in Jewish law, I wasn't going to mention this, but it's actually an interesting note that's probably worth mentioning. We find in various rituals that we use the number three as a way to indicate that something is strong. If you repeat it, if you say something three times, it is significant. So for example, there's a practice called Kiddush Levana. Kiddush Levana is a practice in the beginning of the month when the moon is starting to grow. We can see more of the moon each night. There's a practice of going outside when you see the moon and actually reciting a prayer to God. And as part of that, you turn to people beside you and you wish them peace. You say, Shalom Aleichem. And you're supposed to offer that three times. There are various times in Jewish law where you do that, where you repeat things three times, and it's meant to strengthen what you're saying. I don't know if that's related to 3 days as a transition or not. Ruchama, I see your hand, but I'm going to ask you to wait because I'm going to go through some other numbers first, and then I'll take comments. But that's another sort of three related thing. But let me go to one that's probably a little bit more familiar to people, and that is the number seven. The number seven is something that is holy, something that is spiritual. It's a holy experience. Example, 7 days of creation. The 7 days in which God creates the world. Now you might say to me, God creates the world not in 7 days, but in 6 days. What do you mean, seven? So take a look at source number two, chapter two of Genesis. And God completed on the seventh day his melacha that he had set out. Melacha, the creative tasks that God had set out, are completed not on day six. They're completed on day seven. So the rabbis had a lot of trouble with that because we thought it was supposed to be a six-day creation period. What happened that it ended up being the seventh? So they give different answers. But one dominant answer is that on the seventh, God creates Shabbat. Shabbat is a creation. It's not the absence of creating. It is something that is significant in and of itself. That pause, that is day seven, is something to be created. So I brought you in source number three a midrash, which says the world was just missing Shabbat. It gives you a couple of parables. One is to compare the world to a chuppah for a wedding. And everything is created, but Shabbos is still missing. And the other one is like a ring without the seal on it. Also, the world without Shabbat. It's not yet complete. So it's really a 7 day period of creation. The holidays, I brought you in source number four. The holiday of Sukkot is a 7 day holiday. There's an eighth day, the holiday of Shmini Atzeret, that is viewed as its own unique holiday. It's in many ways, it's different from the previous 7 days. Passover, a 7 day holiday. The fact that we add a day outside of Israel is a rabbinic addition necessary for various reasons, but the core holiday is a 7 day holiday. Even the holiday of Shavuot, which is only observed biblically for 1 day or outside of Israel for 2 days, has a 7 day period of sacrifices in the temple. Seven signifies holiness. And I'll show you in source number five, Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman. Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman lived, as you see, I wrote there, in Germany, and towards the end of the 19th century into the beginning of the 20th century. And look what he says in number five, and then I'll take comments. He says, seven is the divine number, the sacred number, the root and basis of which may be found in the number of the days of creation. In context, Rabbi Hoffman is talking about something that is interesting in its own right and really deserves some explanation. So I'm going to pause to explain it. I'm going to ask you to volunteer to me. Can you name for me a city in southern Israel? Not counting the one that I mentioned where Yidana Kastri. Be'er Sheva. Be'er Sheva. Good.
Be'er Sheva.
Got it on the first try. Sorry?
No, you wanted the south. Eilat is more south.
Eilat is more south, but I wanted Be'er Sheva. You're good. So Be'er Sheva. What does the name Be'er Sheva mean?
Seven wells.
Seven wells? Could be. Or what else could it mean?
Shvuah, from Shvuah.
Exactly. From the word Shvuah, which means an oath. When you look biblically, you actually find both etymologies for the place Be'er Sheva. It was indeed where an oath and a covenant was made, but it is also about the number seven. So in source number five, I feel like it should have been source number seven. I should have done something just to make that happen. Rabbi Hoffman connects those two meanings of the word Sheva. Sheva, seven, Shivuah, oath. He says 7 is the divine number, the sacred number, the root and basis of which may be found in the number of the days of creation. Because of this, they would take 7 objects at the time of an oath. And in his story that he's talking about, Abraham takes 7 lambs when he's going to make a covenant. This is the source, he says, for the verb lehi shava, to swear, meaning to obligate oneself with the sacred number 7. He argues that the number shiva is because sheva is holy. That's his idea. So leave aside whether that's historically the source for the number 7, not that for the word shivua, for an oath. The point is, and this is where I'm going in general with this, is that 7 is not a lucky number in the sense of being something irrelevant. 7 is a number that often signifies something holy. Something holy has happened, and 7 is the tally for it. I'll just give you, in source number 6, I listed for you other examples of this, how 7 is used for spiritual cycles. The period from Passover to Shavuot, right, is 7 weeks. 7 times 7. They had a 7-day period to dedicate the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and they had a 7+7 period, 14-day period, to dedicate the first temple. I gave you the verses so that you could look them up biblically, but I didn't want to take all of our time on just reading the verses. The Sabbath, of course, Shabbat, 7-day cycle. Shemitah, the sabbatical year in Israel to let the land rest, 7-year cycle. And then you have 7 times 7 before you reach the Jubilee year. You're supposed to count 49 years, and then the Jubilee year, when land goes back to the families that held it originally, when slaves are freed. The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, is sequestered from the nation for 7 days before Yom Kippur. And that's tied to some of the other sevens that some of you have talked about, some of you haven't talked about. So the point here is that 7 isn't special in Judaism because it's a lucky number. It's because we have so many times when we see that 7 refers to some period having elapsed or there being a quantity of 7 holy things or creating a holy unit. Okay, you waited really long for this, to be able to comment. I'm sure there are a lot of questions and comments. Rose, you've got your hand up, but I'm going to actually ask Luchama because she was waiting from before. Go ahead.
Okay. About the number 3, I was wondering that in Kriyat Shema, we are doing so many things, so many brachot on 3 times.
So many times,
you know, dafka in Kriyat Shema. And I was wondering why there is a certain reason for it.
So where do you see 3 in Shema?
Oh, many things that we say 3 times.
Like what?
No.
And the only thing I can think of, which may be significant...
Which one?
No, the only thing I can think of is that the opening line of Shema has the name of Hashem 3 times.
Oh, no, but you repeat when you say Kriyat Shema. You repeat this...
Now you're talking about the last 3 words?
No, the sentence.
Oh, we say that twice. We repeat a sentence twice. The one about tying the tefillin and putting the mezuzah on your door, right? That's twice. I'm not sure I know what you mean. If you can find it and let me know.
I don't see the...
Okay.
I mean, Well,
that's not a repeating. That's
not repeated, but three times,
yes. Right. Anyways, and this is one thing. And again, 3, it's very interesting, I think, that there are 3 places in Israel that were bought in full price,
yes,
even though they were all offered to get it free.
Right, that's true. You've got Hebron, you've got Yerushalayim, yeah. You've got Shechem. Right, this is true. There's a lot you can do with 3. We haven't talked about the patriarchs as being a set of 3. There's a lot that you can do for sure with that number. It comes up a lot. It's true. Rose, you're muted.
Yep. I have a question. So circumcision is day 8. Why?
We're getting there.
Not day 7.
We're getting there. We've done 3 and 7. We haven't done 8 yet. Any additional questions and comments? Janine.
Quick one. Just one more. Hazaka, the concept of something being considered regular.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that ties into what I had said before about repeating something 3 times as a way to strengthen it. Janine points out we have a concept in Jewish law that if something happens 3 times, that's considered a pattern such that, you know, unlike the disclaimers of past performance does not guarantee future results, we say, yes, past performance is a strong indicator of future results. So, for example, if an animal attacks others 3 times, it's now assumed to be a dangerous animal, and the owner has a higher standard of protection that's required to prevent harm. There's a discussion in the Talmud. Is that on the 3rd time, or is that after 3 times? But certainly we find 3 times being very significant in that regard. I see the note in the chat. When people say Shema before bedtime, if you look in a traditional Siddur, you will find also certain verses to be repeated 3 times. Not just there, it has in other contexts as well, but that's a good example. And yes, it's about strengthening the impact. Tfilas Haderech, the prayer that people say when traveling, right? The wayfarer's prayer. So also has verses to be repeated 3 times. Same concept. Do it three times, that strengthens it. Let's talk 8. Because the question was asked, what about 8? So 8 in Judaism often signifies the supernatural. 7 days represents a holy experience, a holy cycle, and one of those cycles we said is the creation of the world. 8 is what comes next. After the creation of nature, you then get the supernatural. The Maharal of Prague, best known to many people as the creator of the golem, although, as we've discussed on other occasions, unlikely that he ever created a golem. There isn't, you know, we don't find evidence in his writings about it, you know, that to indicate that he did. You know, there's one hint of something that may sort of, if you look at it funny, be read that way. But it's a story that was propagated after his time. But he was brilliant rabbi and mystic. And take a look at source number 7 from a line of his in his commentary to the Talmud. The Talmud states, circumcision is very important, as seen in the fact that it overrides Shabbat. Right? If a baby's day 8 is Shabbos, so we do the bris. Right? Barring certain circumstances. But generally speaking, if day 8 is Shabbos, we do the bris. So he comments on that and says, that's obvious. He says, of course it would override Shabbos. For circumcision is on the 8th day, and the number 8 is entirely above nature. 7 days, he says, are parallel to the 7 days of creation. Circumcision is a state which is above nature. And therefore, circumcision is on the 8th day, after 7. It's not joined to the 7 mundane days. The principle is that circumcision is on a higher level than Shabbat, and therefore it overrides Shabbat. Now, there's a lot to be said about that. The idea that circumcision is improving on nature is actually a discussion in the Talmud, about what that means. But let's not stop with circumcision. What holiday is an 8-day holiday?
Hanukkah,
precisely. Hanukkah is an 8-day holiday, and the Maharal has a comment which I did not end up bringing you on the sheet, where he says also because it symbolizes the miracle. Also, I mentioned that Sukkot is a 7-day holiday, and then you have this 8th day, Shmini Atzeret. So the sages talk about this. If you look in the Torah's description of the sacrifices that are brought on the holiday of Sukkot, on those 7 days, you find that they bring bulls. They bring a total of 70 bulls. It's a different number each day. It starts, if I remember correctly, at 14? No, 14 is the lamb. Starts at 13, and then 12, and then 11, and 10, and 9, and 8, and 7. You bring a total of 70 bulls. And then, Shmini Atzeret, that last day, the 8th day, you bring just one. And the idea is that the 70 represent the 70 nations of the world, and the one bull represents the Jewish people. We are after the other seven. They represent the natural world, and then we have our holiday that represents the supernatural. So 8 is meant to be supernatural. And then let's talk 10. 10 signifies something that is complete. So if you were to look in the Torah, you would find a verse that describes God speaking to the Jews at Sinai with Aseret HaDevarim, 10 statements, which people call, right, the 10 commandments. The truth of the matter is that it's hard to actually hit 10 when you read that section in the Torah, because there are more than 10 commandments in that section, but it becomes important to us to figure out how to make it 10, because the Torah says in Exodus chapter 34 that God issued 10 statements at Sinai. But not just there. Take a look at source number 8, where I brought you the Mishnah from Pirkei Avot. The world was created with 10 divine declarations. 10 times God says something should come into existence. Although one of those is actually not in "and God said," but I'm not going there right now. There were 10 generations from Adam to Noah, and then God got fed up. 10 generations from Noah to Abraham, and then God said, "Aha, see, it was worth it for me to be patient." Abraham was tested with 10 tests. When you see a census in the Torah, you often see that numbers are rounded to a 10, sometimes to 100. Somebody mentioned, I think it was Mark, who mentioned in an earlier session, the 10 spirot, the 10 divine emanations. That's in mysticism. If you take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Moshe Cordovero says, "It is well known regarding the number of spirot. The spirot refer to God's influence on this world." So he says, all who are involved with this hidden knowledge have agreed as one that there are 10 spirot. There is no debate in this at all. I feel like he's just waiting for somebody to jump out of a closet and say, "I disagree," you know, when he insists that way. But he says, this is one of the matters in which the covenant has been executed regarding knowledge of the Sphirot. It is 10. And that has all sorts of applications in Judaism for purposes that are going to go beyond the scope of what we're discussing right now. But the point is, 10 represents something that is complete. I'm going to pause here. I see notes in the chat. The test for Avraham of circumcision, what number was that? So there's a lot of debate as to how to count the Avraham's tests and where, you know, which one was which number. And that one is relatively early on in his career. That's before things like the Akedah, right? The binding of Isaac, which is a test. It's not the 10th test. It's far from the 10th test. The Noahide laws are 7. This is true. It's actually really interesting because we say there are 7 Noahide laws, but there are actually more like 11. The Talmud has a whole discussion about other ones that are on the list that aren't in the standard count. But yes, we usually think of 7 Noahide laws. So what we're getting here, again, is that numbers are not necessarily something extraneous, but rather they represent something that has meaning. So we've got 7 as something holy or spiritual. It's also the natural versus 8 being the supernatural. We have 3 as a journey. We have 10 representing something complete. So far, we've talked about positive things. There's also the negative side. So maybe I'll do this and then take questions and comments. 40 is often a bad number in the Torah. I seem to remember reading somewhere some line from Stephen King saying, when you see the number 40 in the Torah, it's a bad sign. I seem to remember that. Yeah, I don't remember where I saw that. But take a look at source number 10, where I brought you a list of the terrible 40s. This is not an exhaustive list. There are more that definitely fit. You've got the flood, right? 40 days of rain. And then there's a 40-day period after the ark comes to rest as well, before they're able to leave. After the golden calf, Moses has to plead with God for 40 days not to destroy the Jews. You have the spies. After the spies come back with their negative report about the land of Israel, and all the people cry and say, we don't want to go into the land, this is terrible. So God condemns them to be in the wilderness for 40 years. The prophet Jonah is sent to the city of Nineveh to warn them, in another 40 days, the city is going to be destroyed. Lashes, biblical lashes, are 39. But the way it's presented in the Torah is that there are 40. And there's a lot of rabbinic discussion about why we only give 39. We don't give the full 40. But the Torah says, Arba'im yakenu, to strike 40 times. 40 represents, often represents punishment. Now, there are other uses of 40 that really don't fit. So, for example, you also have 40... You also have a period of 40 days when Moses is learning the Torah on top of Sinai. You have 40 years that King David was king. You have the prophet Elijah takes a 40-day trip at one point. Like, you have other 40s. I see in the chat, 40 weeks of gestation. So I think for the woman, she might well say, yeah, 40 days is a period, 40 weeks is a period of suffering. She may well feel that way. I'm not sure how to view that one. Yeah, Ian, I see you laughing. There will always be numbers that don't fit. And frankly, we often see, or sometimes see, 400 as a number that's associated with punishment as well, or suffering as well. The Jews are supposed to be in Egypt for 400 years, as an example. Esav comes to greet Jacob with an army of 400 men. Yes, Leah, you are correct. Solomon also rules for 40 years. So these numbers are not, it's not as though every time you see 40, that means bad, punishment. It's not so. But frequently it does come up that way. Questions and comments? Yes, Ricky.
I'm asking about the supernatural. Since Hashem created everything, how can there be anything outside everything?
So, from a God perspective, it's not outside. Meaning, from God's perspective, God created this and God created that. However, there is that which is in the realm that we inhabit, and then there is that which is external to that. In the same way, we have an idea in the Talmud that there are certain things that God created before creating the universe. Right? We're told that there are seven things that precede. One is Torah, right? Another one is the power of repentance. One is the Garden of Eden. Another one is Gehenna, the place of punishment. One of them is the Beit HaMikdash, the temple. Another one is the divine throne in the heavens. And the name of Mashiach, of the Messiah. Now, obviously, it doesn't mean these are physical things that are being created. You can't create a temple before there is a Jerusalem. That doesn't make any sense. But these are concepts that must exist in order for there to be a universe. So they exist within, but they also have their own separate identity. So you could argue for that in terms of the supernatural as well. There are things that are special, that are outside of the realm of everything else, but from God's perspective, it's all God's creation. That's the way I would look at it. Yes, Eti.
What is where does it show in the Bible the 40 lashes?
The verse itself, Arba'im yakenu lo yosif. It's Parsha Shoftim. I have a turn off here. Sorry.
They actually hit people 40 times.
So carried it out with 39. And it was only, as the Mishnah explains it, the way that they would carry it out was that they had a doctor evaluate, and they would do it in sets of three. And if the doctor said, I think he can only take, let's say, seven, then they would give six. They would have medical care on the scene. The point of lashes, as explained by various sages, was not so much the pain of it as it was to embarrass the person, effectively. It was a declaration of guilt. That was really the goal, as it's often explained. It's the book of Deuteronomy, Devarim, and I believe that it is in the Parsha of Shoftim, but I'm not 100% sure. I'll have to take a look.
No, I was just wondering who did receive for the last 39 lashes.
So it would have to be somebody who violated biblical law knowingly and with a warning, and saying, "I accept your warning, and I'm doing it on that basis." In order, it's hard to actually end up carrying out a physical punishment to somebody. The standards are pretty high.
Because they're showing stoning all over the place.
So that's not all over the place. I mean, there are certain cases, and also that one's even harder to carry out. That one is even harder. I'm just cheating by looking on my computer. Since I have a computer open, I might as well make use of it. But of course it's freezing because of Zoom. It was faster to look in my book.
Never mind, don't worry.
Thanks. Yes. Sorry?
Can I say something?
Yes. Oh, there it is. Okay. It's Deuteronomy chapter 25, sentence 3. That's why I missed it. And Rose, the answer to your question is no. It's not about that. Actually, isn't the punishment for that? No. We can talk about it more after. But yeah, and the answer is yes. To answer your second comment, yes, the men get it too. Yes, Muhammad.
Okay. So about 40. Shlomo also reigned 40 years.
Right. That was that. Somebody had noted that in the chat. Yeah. Leah had noted that. Yeah.
And when I mentioned Kriyat Shema, that we say three times, Yevarchecha Hashem v'Yishmerecha, we say Sigadai, Hinei lo yanum v'lo yishan, three times.
So now I understand what you mean. You're talking about what I think it was Margie wrote in the chat before about Kriyat Shema Hamita, meaning not Shema, but at night before going to sleep. Yeah, no, that one said.
Yes.
Yeah, no, and that's about right, that's about strengthening the idea. Okay. I'm going to note another number, and then we'll move on to the next type of so to speak, lucky number. But I'll note 600,000. 600,000, roughly, is the sum of the Jewish military in the wilderness. Meaning, when they did a military census, they came out with 600,000 and a little bit. Both in the beginning of the, or early on in the period in the wilderness, and at the end, it's roughly the same number of 600,000, and therefore it comes to mean a large population. So as an example, take a look at source number 11, where the Talmud talks about a very large synagogue in Alexandria, in Egypt, in Talmudic times. I feel like people are frozen on my screen. Can you hear me? I shouldn't have looked that up on my CD before. That was a mistake. Hang in there for those listening to the recording. Zoom is just restarting. There it goes.
There you are.
Okay, there I am. There I am. Yeah, no, sorry about that. So I'm not sure what...
It's not
sorry about that. I'm not sure what you heard last, but my computer thought that when I looked for that thing online, on my CD before, it was a mistake. You heard me when I talked about... You heard me when I talked about 600,000?
I said you're 4 to 3 times, another number yeah. 4 to 3.
You heard what I said about the 600,000? Yes, okay. So 600,000 was the military census in the wilderness, and it comes to mean a large population. If you take a look at source number 11 from the Talmud, they're describing a very large synagogue in Alexandria in Egypt. Rabbi Yehuda said, "One who never saw the Dioplos stone of Alexandria of Egypt has never seen the glory of Israel." They said it was like a big basilica, a platform within a platform. That's the Dioplos stone in the name there. And sometimes there were double the number who left Egypt in it, meaning double that military census, 1.2 million. And Margie, thanks for your clarification in the chat. We're good. Understood. So these are examples of numbers that, again, have inherent significance. Let's talk about the third kind of number. The number that everybody knows is irrelevant, but it gives us a psychological, emotional boost, and therefore we value it. We don't make decisions based on it. It's simply something that we feel good about. So an interesting example of this comes up in the writings of Don Isaac Abarbanel. Some of you learned the following story with me. King David is on the run from Saul. Saul wants to kill him, and David runs away to the Mishkan, the tabernacle, in the city of Nob, to get support. He tells them he's on a mission from Saul. He lies to them about what he's doing. He needs to in order to save his life. And he asks them for food and a weapon. And when he asks for food, he asks for 5 loaves of bread, which is a very strange thing for him to ask for, because he's one person. What's he going to do with 5 loaves of bread? And the commentators discuss why he asks for 5 loaves. One answer is that he told the priest he was talking to that he had aides with him, but that they were hidden because they were worried about being caught, so they were waiting elsewhere. So he's telling him 5 in order to convince him, look, I have more people with me. And that's one explanation. There are various explanations, but look at what Don Isaac Abarbanel says to explain why David asks for 5 loaves. Source number 12. He asked for 5 loaves parallel to the 5 books of the Torah. Chumash. This was the most sacred number to David. 5 was a special number. And that's why he composed the Book of Psalms as 5 separate books. There are 5 units within the Book of Psalms. 5 is a special number for David. That may explain, if you were to look in the Book of Samuel 1, chapter 17, you would find that when David is going to fight Goliath, he takes 5 stones. And the commentators all wrestle with why 5 stones, and they give different explanations. But you could take this answer here. He really liked the number 5. It sounds a little bit bizarre that David would have been like, yeah, 5's a cool number. Let me ask for my lucky number, 5. But we do this all the time. And here I come back to something I mentioned in, I forget if it was the first week or the second week. When I was growing up in my synagogue, Rabbi Blech, right, Benjamin Blech, was the rabbi of the shul. And I remember vividly that every year for Rosh Hashanah, as part of his speech, he would give a new explanation for the acronym of the year. Meaning, the Jewish calendar year is represented in numbers, and as we discussed with Gematria last week, each number has a parallel letter. So this year is 5782. So we automatically usually drop the thousands, since the thousands don't change very often, right? Once in 1,000 years. Everybody takes the thousands as a given. So nobody bothers to put the letter hey for the 5. However, that leaves us with 782. So 782 would be Tuf Shin Pei Bet. If you have the sheet from last week, you have my gematria chart, you can see how it works. But the 700 is Tuf and Shin, because Tuf is 400 and Shin is 300. And then 80 is letter Pei. And the number 2 is Bet. So Rabbi Blech, every single year, would come up with what Tuf, Shin, whatever it was, worked with. And it was really easy, because when you have Tuf and Shin, you could always do Tihyeh Shinat. It shall be a year of, and then you have whatever words are left. I realize this is a lot clearer for people who speak Hebrew. I apologize for everybody else, but I think it's worth the diversion for a minute. Because in source number 13, I gave you my acronym for 5782. Tiyeh Shnat Pfizer BioNTech. it should be the year of Pfizer BioNTech. It works out really, really well. Top Shin Pei Bet Tiesh Not Pfizer BioNTech. I think that's great. The Moderna folks didn't pay me enough, so I only got the Pfizer one.
BioNTech
is part of the name. It's the two companies that work together to make the vaccine.
Actually, the main company that did all the work is BioNTech, as an FYI.
So I will note that Mark Zuckerberg would disagree, and I gave you a number 14, Tia Schnat Facebook, would also work. So you could also do that, and so on and so on and so on. You can have a lot of fun with this if you like. People actually do real things with these numbers, meaning people take this quasi-seriously. So I'll give you an example. I remember the year 1984 was Tafshin Mem Daled. Tafshin Mem Daled spells Tishamed, which means you shall be destroyed. So people would not write Tafshin Mem Daled. They would flip the last two letters. They would write Tafshin Daled Mem in order not to say something bad. Not that they felt like it was meaningful, but they felt they didn't want to associate with that. I actually gave a class separately about issues of opening one's mouth to the Satan and things like that, but that's a separate conversation. I'm not really going there right now. I see your hand, Ricky. I'm just going to go through a couple of more notes on this, and then I'll pause. The number 18, which we've said symbolizes life, right, could be a prayer for life. We talked about that, like the messages we send to God. But it can also be just a nice association. We like the number 18. It makes us feel good. The last one that I'm going to bring in this category is the number 17. And this one is a strange one on multiple levels. I'm going to explain it. There is a practice for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur of people avoiding eating nuts. Right? Show of hands. How many people are familiar with that? Not eating nuts, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? Okay, I see a bunch of hands here. Thank you. And Etty shaking her head like, what are you talking about? But there are a lot of people who have a practice not to eat nuts, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. The simple reason why is in source number 15, Rabbi Yaakov Molin, Maharil, Laws of Shofar. He says, everyone should be careful not to cough during shofar blowing, so they'll hear the total sound and not interrupt even a hair's breadth, right? You don't want to be the guy who they're blowing shofar and now people can't hear because you have a hacking cough suddenly. Not that anybody did the last couple of years. We were very, very careful. There are conflicting views as to whether the essential part of the sound is the beginning or the end, so you have to hear the entire sound. Therefore, one should not eat anything which can lead to phlegm and mucus on Rosh Hashanah. Therefore, some are careful not to eat nuts on Rosh Hashanah before shofar because they increase fluids. That's what he writes, and that's something I actually found some scientific material on it. It's fascinating in its own right. That's the simple reason to avoid nuts. However, take a look at source number 16. Rabbi Moshe Isserles says, some are careful not to eat nuts, meaning Rosh Hashanah, because the word egos, Hebrew word for nut, is of the same gematria as the word chet, which means sin. Now, he then brings you, also, they increase phlegm and mucus, they make it harder for you to pray, but he brings this gematria. Now, some of you are going to do the math and recognize the word egos in gematria. Aleph is 1, gimel is 3, that makes 4. Vav is 6, that makes 10. And then zayin is 7, that's 17. The word chet, the way we spell it, is chet tet aleph, which is 18. So when people think 18 is life, you should know 18 is also chet, which means sin. Every time somebody claps al chet, right? Chet is also 18. But there is a potential spelling of the word chet without the aleph at the end, so it'll be 17. So it doesn't mean that nuts are somehow connected to sin. That's not what it's trying to say. It's simply an association that people make. And Mark notes in the chat, you know, 17 also equals the word tov, which means good. So this is certainly true. I just bring this to you as an example, again, of a number that people assign significance to. Clear? Questions and comments before we go further. Okay. So I'll take
sounds like a make-work project.
It can be. It totally can be. If you have kids who have just learned the Hebrew alphabet and you want to give them like an exercise to work on that'll help them become more familiar with it, this is really good. Tell them to come up with gematrias. I think that's a handy exercise. Rosalind and then Ricky.
Oh, what did somebody like Maimonides, he was such a rationalist. What did he think of gematria? Does he have comments and commentary on it?
So that's a really interesting question. He doesn't have commentary on it, and he doesn't speak, as far as I am familiar, about any gematrias like this variety of gematria. However, there is gematria which becomes relevant in terms of Jewish law. I gave you references to that last week when we talked about the Nazirite and how the period of being a Nazir is 30 days, and they associate it with the word Yehiyeh. The gematria of the word Yehiyeh, there are some that are like that. But what we said at that point was that gematria in those contexts is really not viewed as like this is the message from the Torah as much as it is a message we create. It's a mnemonic that we create for a law that's already known. It's not the source of the law. So we don't really get Maimonides commenting on this variety of gematria that I am familiar with. I will point out what we said in the beginning of last week when we said that the idea of gematria comes from the idea that the Torah has a layer of interpretation called remez, hints. And that's something that is accepted broadly, although Maimonides doesn't. If I can remember correctly, I don't think Maimonides speaks to that directly. I don't think he does. Mark. Actually, sorry, I said I was going to take Ricky, I think, but I don't see her. She disappeared on my screen. Oh, there she is. You moved. Ricky and then Mark.
This is Dr. Munchia, but you were talking about flipping letters. That's what we do when we don't want foots for number 15. When we don't want to write Yud Hey and we write Tet Vav.
Right. So that's a separate, right. The Tet Vav is a different issue. The Tet Vav issue is because writing the letters Yud and Hey, that's one of God's names that can't be erased. So people will write the numerical equivalent of Yud Hey, they'll write Tet Vav. Right.
But this is to do with the strength of letters. This is something that's so strong that we can't even.
Well, it's because you're not allowed to erase God's name. You have a biblical commandment not to erase it. So that's why we don't do it. I'm going to take Mark's comment, but then I want to go further because we're running out of time, even though we have 7 minutes to go, not four. But nonetheless, yes, Mark.
So I wasn't able to hear all of it. You may have dealt with it. But have you mentioned Ashbash? My point is that there's so many tricks you can play.
Yeah.
There's so many equivalents. It's impossible. You could do anything when you manipulate it, when you use all these different.
And that's certainly right. And often you do, because again, you're looking for messages that have meaning for you. You can do that. But I didn't mention it because this is really about numbers. There are a lot more code things that we could have gone into. That is true. So I want to just mention quickly intertextuality in the context of Jewish law. We've already seen that numbers can be used to link stories biblically. When we talked about the number 3, if you were to go back to the beginning of the source sheet, source number 1, and we connected all these stories that have 3-day journeys and transitions, so we link 3s. I wanted to show you an area in Jewish law where that's done. In source number 17, is a passage in the Talmud dealing with the question of whether there is a legal requirement to sit in the sukkah on the first night of Sukkot. Meaning, the mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah is, if I'm going to eat a meal during Sukkot, I have to eat it in the sukkah. So let's say I decide on the first night of Sukkot, I'm not going to eat a meal. I'll eat what doesn't qualify as a meal. I'll have something to drink. I'll eat a snack. I'm not going to have a meal. Do I have to sit in the sukkah? So if you take a look at source number 17, they do the following analysis. They say that the Torah says Sukkot is on the 15th day of the month, and Passover is on the 15th day of its month. So just like on Passover, the Torah says that you have to eat matzah the first night, and the rest of the holiday, you just don't eat chametz, but you don't have to eat matzah. So too for Sukkot, the first night of eating a meal in the sukkah is obligatory. The rest of the time, it's optional. You don't have to eat a particular meal. So they link the laws of Sukkot and the laws of Passover because each of them happens on the 15th of the month. So that's another use of numbers that I thought was interesting. But for my last point, and I'll stick around for a few minutes after that, and I'll also note, for anyone who has to leave, please remember our big Tanakh tour of the land of Israel is on Sunday. Please sign up. If you have not already signed up, I'm going to send out the link in the follow-up email from today. Also, please sign up for our Chana series, the Biblical Chana, that's happening in January. A three-parter, it's going to be fun, as well as the Idan series. There's a lot of learning coming up. This is good. So the last point that I wanted to mention is about counting Jews. We find several times biblically that people are counted indirectly. So I brought you in source number 18, where Moses is told, when you want to count the heads of the children of Israel according to their number, have them each give a payment, a half shekel, and they won't have a plate. There will be something harmful that will happen if you count them individually. So let them donate the half shekel and count the half shekel instead. And that half shekel is used as a donation for the temple. That's its own discussion. Another example in source number 19, where King David says to his general Yoav, I want you to do a census of the army. And Yoav says to him, you're not supposed to do that. Why in the world would you do that? There are so many soldiers, don't do this. And David says, no, I want you to go out and do it. And then he regrets it. I'm rushing, but you can see it here. He feels guilty and he says to God, I have sinned terribly in counting the people. Remove the sin of your servant. We even have passages in Samuel 1, chapter 11, and Samuel 1, chapter 15, in which there is a census, a military census, where they don't count the people one by one. Rather, they count them with stones, or they count them with sheep. And in fact, it's brought as law. Roslyn asked about Maimonides. Maimonides records as law that you're not supposed to count individuals. Rose, what you're talking about is a separate thing that may be connected. I can come back to it at the end. But what's this all about? This business of not counting people. Why is it that we're allergic to counting people? So if you take a look at source number 20, you find what the Talmud says. The Talmud first notes the examples of where Saul counted people using something other than just counting the people. And then it explains. Because God says to the Jewish people in the book of Hosea, the count of the children of Israel will be as the sand of the sea, which is immeasurable. And it actually goes on to say immeasurable and uncountable. That's what God promised. We will become so many that we can't be counted. So for us to count ourselves is to violate that aspiration. We want the blessing of being beyond counting. We don't even want to have as many as the grains of sand. We want to be absolutely innumerable, which we are. Not all at once necessarily physically, but across time. With the way that we have endured, we are all one big nation. We are, in fact, innumerable. So we don't limit ourselves by counting ourselves. That's the idea. And it is true that sometimes you need a number. Sometimes you need to know, is there a minion, for example? Or tragically, terribly, Miriam notes, counting the victims of the Holocaust. There's actually a major debate in Israel regarding how to do the census. You need a number. You need to do a census sometimes. So, you know, that's a whole concept and a whole issue in Jewish law about how to count when you actually need to count people. But I, you know, that's our overall principle, is we don't limit ourselves. There is also, I saw the note in the chat before, there is the idea of ayin hara. If a person counts their children, right, it's like you're showing off your good fortune. There are other issues as well that are involved. But this is the Talmud's explanation for why we don't do counting. Okay, thank you very, very much, everyone. Those who have to go can go. It's 11:03. I said 1 hour. We got an hour. I'll stick around for a few minutes, though, to discuss further. Thank you, and I hope to see you on Sunday as well as in January.
Thank you, everybody.
After the session ended, I realized that I had not stated myself clearly enough in the last part about counting Jews. So I'm just going to add a note here. The problem is not knowing the sum of people. The problem is the act of counting one by one. It's fine for the Torah to tell us there were 70 of these, or there were 603,550 of those. That's fine. The problem is the act of counting them one by one.